Hi, this is Amy.
And this is Andrew, and in this episode, AADL talks to Doug Harvey.
In this episode, former Washtenaw County Sheriff Doug Harvey shares his memories of the turbulent 1960s in Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti. Harvey recalls the many personal, political, and law enforcement challenges he encountered during his years as sheriff, from the UFO sightings in 1966 and the South University riots, to the co-ed murders and the John Norman Collins case. He also responds to some of the criticism surrounding his reputation and speaks candidly about the community leaders and colleagues he admired during these years and those he did not.
You know, we'll never go through an era again like we did in the 60s. Never. In Washtenaw County. I can recall that, you know, we were on national television. People, my friends were in California, said, I seen you on television on the Cronkite show. And I used to think when I'd come to work, and a lot of times I wouldn't stay right at the jail, but I'd come to work and here it'd be Channel 4, 2, and 7, you know. So it was just a real turmoil. And I happened to see the, there was a movie yesterday, The Boston Strangler. And I was watching that, and he strangled 10 women. And they called in Peter Hercules, as did Ann Arbor Police Chief called in Peter Hercules. Anyway, when Peter Hercules come there, I was not a believer. Please believe me. We're going to solve this case with good old-fashioned police work, not with some psychic saying, I see this happening. Anyway, they brought him to the scene on Huron River Drive, and I can't remember what victim it was, but anyway, we had stationed people around with the prosecutor's authority and with the theory that a murderer always comes back to the scene, okay? Unfortunately, my poor men were in the woods and stationed around, and there was mosquitoes, and they were just being, you know, eaten alive, them poor guys. And then finally one of them shouted, I think he's here, and somebody ran, and I don't know if they did that just to get the devil out of there, saying, this is not working, you know. So I'll never know. But anyway, the chief brought Peter Hercules to that scene. And he said, Peter Hercules introduced him, so on. I said, okay, he wants to go down and examine the scene where the body was laying. I said, he can't go down there. Now we got state police crime lab in here. So when all the investigation's done, we're all through the scene, let him do what he wants. So I watched him after we got done. And he went down and he put his hand like this, and he just kept going like this where the body was laying. And I'm sitting there saying, oh, my God, what a show this is, you know. That night he held a press conference. I did not go, wouldn't go. There was no question I wasn't going. So he told, in Channel 4, and then we're all there, and he told them, I see a young man who will have foreign money in his wallet. He was not born in this country. Now, these are supposed to be clues, okay? And I see a homemade ladder. Wow. You know, I thought to myself, that's really weird. I mean, what's that going to do with us? When we arrested John Norman Collins, he had $5 Canadian in his wallet. He was born in Canada. In the house that he was babysitting for his uncle, who was a Michigan State Trooper, if you remember. When we went down to that basement, up against the wall was a homemade ladder. But at the time, you can understand my theory. I got detectives, state police, and everything, and all of us got together and says, "What do you make of it?" I says, "Nothing, absolutely nothing." We're going to go out and look for a young man with foreign money in his wallet and not born here in the country, and look for a homemade ladder. But it was just very odd. And then, of course, as you know, Mr. Ralph Keyes came here and wrote The Michigan Murders. And I don't know if you read that book or not, but Mr. Keyes also wrote The French Connection. And when he came here, God, he had me on the phone from New York at one time for over 3.5 hours on the phone. On the phone, you know. And he really glamorized that story, you know. And there's a couple of things in there that he did, that they put in there that I said, but I really didn't say that. And my grandchildren are reading this book, you know. Grandpa, did you really say this? I said, no, I really didn't.
What were they? What were the things?
Well, that they had said regarding Peter Hercules that I would not urinate in his ear if his brains were on fire. I never said anything like that in my life, you know. I used a lot of foul language, you know, at various times, but I never said anything like that. But, again, he just blew a lot of things up, and he did a pretty good job on it as far as the actual scenes and so on. So he did a lot of research, but he had to glorify it, you know, like they did the French Connection. You know, he did some things. And then, of course, when he came here and he was on the he told me when he left, when the book comes out, I will make sure you get an autographed copy. I said, I would really appreciate that, you know. And he was on the Ted Heisel show, and we were talking, so people were calling in, so I called in. I said, Mr. Keyes, and of course, Ted Heisel recognizes my voice right away. He said, well, this is Sheriff Harvey. He said, yeah. I said, where's my book? And he said, I am going to give it to you personally tomorrow. And he did. I got it. The turmoil that we had during the 60s was just unreal. It was just unreal. We had the welfare mothers. We had the Vietnam War protesters. We had the Michigan murders. And then we had the campus riots. And all of that going on, it just daily. It was always something daily. We went over to we got a call over at Eastern Michigan, which was normally a quiet university, and we got over there. And at that time, Mr. Sponberg was the president. What a fabulous guy he was. He was just a dynamic individual. I really liked him. He was just he was my kind of people, you know. And when we got over there, the students had barricaded themselves in one of the buildings, chained it, barricaded themselves. And Sponberg met me as I came over there. And I said, what you would like to do, Mr. Sponberg? He says, you're the sheriff. That's my building. Get them out of there. And we did, you know. And the same thing happened when we had some protesters on his campus. And they were having a big meeting. In fact, Humphrey was here. That's what it was. And I had to go on the backstage, and the president was there, and I, psst, psst, like this. He came out, and I said, you got a big ado going on your campus. He says, are they my students? I said, I don't know. I said, there's some U of M. He said, the U of M students, arrest them. The other ones, get their names, because they're all through with this school. And he meant it. He was dynamic, you know.
You felt differently about Robin Fleming, right? Can you talk a little bit
yes.
about the conflict with Robin Fleming?
I didn't like him, plain and simple. I thought he was a jerk. Robin Fleming was never for law enforcement. Several times we had a clash where the students took over the building, and here we lined up, and he made a comment, I don't want the brown shirts on my campus. Made that comment several times. And I informed him, this is still Washtenaw County, and that we will do as we see fit in order to maintain the peace and tranquility. And one particular scene was on East U, when the students were really, really coming. And we had, at that time, we had Oakland County Sheriff Department, we had Livingston County Sheriff Department, we had the Michigan State Police. But we were leading basically the surge as far as moving the students down. So, 'cause they were breaking windows and they were doing things in the streets and so on. And Fleming met us right at North U and South U, or East U, and right there by the where all the streets are. Well, I forget. But anyway, Bill Delahaye was there with the prosecutor. Chief Walt Krasny was there. And I was there. And Mr. Fleming says, if you people were to stop pushing us, I will get my students out of here, and especially you. He pointed at me. And I said to him, uncertain words. And I said to him, "Mr. Fleming, one more rock, one more brick comes towards my men, and I'll clean them out myself." No sooner said that, and here come the bricks. So, I mean, they were really coming. And, you know, some of my men talk about this, and they laugh. Because as we were going down East U, I was in front of them, my men, basically, and I had my arm was broken, and I had a tear gas gun in my hand, and you can just uncock it easy. And I had a deputy there. I said, throw in a tear gas bomb. Well, we didn't want any lights. We told the television cameras, keep them cameras off of us. We don't want all these lights on us, and we don't want us that vulnerable, you know. And I told my deputy to put a hand grenade in there for tear gas, and he threw in a parachute hand grenade. So when I shot it up in the air, it lit the whole sky up. And I said, "Oh my God!" Talking about dumb cops, you know. We tell them television cameras don't do this. And he said, "Oh, gee, Sheriff, I'm sorry. But anyway, so we had some humorous things after we got through, and got through talking about some of the things that we did. And there were some trying times. Then on the other times when they came down Heron Street, right in front of the jail, or in front of the police department, and we had state police and everybody else down there. State police were in the basement. They were a little political. "If you need us, call." Okay. So our men and the Ann Arbor police lined the whole thing. And they were parading. They came around by the Ann Arbor News at that time, and they started coming down. And there was probably 5,000. It didn't take much to get them riled up. They were already riled because they'd already come down from the campus, and they already did their destruction up there. And they were coming down. They were going down. What they were planned was to come down Heron Street and then go right up Main Street and cause more destruction. So our plan was, we're going to stop them. You know, they're not going to go any further. And so I had given the order that as soon as they made that turn and start coming down, start going out, start breaking that crowd up. And one of my deputies, and we were going after these individuals and grabbing them and trying to put them in the bus and so on. So they were starting to spread out because we were making our move. One of my deputies came up to me and said, "Sheriff, with all the commotion," he said, "I lost my gun." I said, "You lost your gun? What?" "Well, I had it unstrapped," he says, "on my holster, and fighting with these guys, my gun come out." And I said, "Oh, my God, I hope nobody gets..." And luckily, we just happened to be looking around, and right on the middle of the street, there that gun lay. And here were all these people. Do you remember the cleaners that was across the street from the Ann Arbor News, or across the street from the Ann Arbor Fire Department? There was a cleaners there, and there was an alley, but a dead end. A bunch of them ran into that alley. When they got there, said, "Oh, my God, it's a brick wall. There's nowhere they can go." So we sealed them off. We had them contained right away. And, of course, the crowd busted up. And so we were lucky. We got out of that one fairly lucky. But there was just some time. It was just a different era. And I was a young, aggressive, young police officer. And... there was just no way they were going to run our county. Sometimes I look back, could have been done another way? I don't know. You know, you look at hindsight and look back and say, "Oh, gee, could we have done something different? How could we have prevented this?" There was no way. State police figured the same thing. No way are we going to prevent it. And we had documentation from a group of radicals that were in Berkeley that were also here at the U of M. Stirring them up. That same group, when we had a photographer and so on, was also at Eastern Michigan. I guess a humorous part, too. When Eastern Michigan, when they were a whole bunch of the during the day, they were really starting to gather, okay, and they were coming up Cross Street, not causing any destruction, just gathering, just blocking the whole street and so on. So we were not taking, we wanted to really see if that group from Berkeley or any of the other were in that. So I had my photographer, Harold Kerr, detective, in the back seat of my car, and I had my undersheriff with me, and we were going down slowly, and I wanted him to take pictures, film, movie film, okay, also video, okay, you know. And he's taking these pictures, and I probably shouldn't say it, but I had to, one of the humorous parts, okay? And evidently, he spotted a young woman who was well-endowed, and he made the comment about how endowed she was. That night, I took the film to the Board of Regents at Eastern Michigan, not knowing what was, I mean, here we go. Not knowing, and we're playing that film, and oh my God, that came on, and they all busted out laughing. And I was so embarrassed, you know. I mean, he zoomed right in on her, you know. It was just
you started in 1965, and the SDS, the Students for Democratic Society, were already on campus, and then
yep.
A couple years later were the Detroit riots, and then some of the folks, the White Panthers, came to Ann Arbor. Were you aware in 65 that Ann Arbor was sort of a hotbed of counterculturalism, and was that something that you talked about in the sheriff's office?
Yes, we knew it, and it, because of the university, and this is why we knew this was a hotbed here. We, you know, and like I say, we had the riots in Detroit, and the sheriff called me up, and he says, "I need some help." This is the Wayne County sheriff. "I want to bring some prisoners up there and put them in your jail," he said, "because we got them at the field house at the state fairgrounds." And he says, "We got some going to Jackson Prison. They're going to house some for us." And he said, "We got," and I said, "Gee, I got a small jail." And I said, "How many are you planning on bringing?" He says, 100. I said, "Oh, no, I cannot take 100. I said, he said, "Well, can you take a busload? That's 55. I says, "Okay. We'll accept that. Bring 55. And when they came over, those prisoners on that bus all the way from the fairgrounds had to ride like this. And there was a deputy in front with a shotgun and the deputy in the back with shotguns. I mean, these were rioters. And the majority were black, naturally. And when we got them to the jail, they smelled. Oh, they were terrible because they hadn't bathed in days. And sitting on the cold ground in the, you know where the state fairgrounds are. That's dirt in there. That's where they were housed. So as soon as we got up there, I put them in one of our big cells, which normally would hold 20, okay? So we put them in there, and we gave them soap and so on, and shower up and clean up, and we gave them a prison garb. And I told them, I said, let them get cleaned up and so on. As fate would have it, the next day, I called Booker Williams, who was a black prosecutor, if you remember at that time, and I called the mayor of Ann Arbor and got him there because I wanted to make sure that, because I knew there was going to be a big blast about how we were treating, and I said, I want them three to come here, and I want them to go through the jail and show them how we treated these individuals, because we knew he was going to get a black eye for it, just sure as the thing. I called him, told him to meet us, like, for example, at 10 o'clock, and they said, okay. In the meantime, my captain came downstairs, and he says, "Sheriff, we got a problem." And I says, "What?" He said, "With those Detroit prisoners." I said, "Are they raising the devil?" And he says, "No, one's dead." And I said, "You got to be kidding." He says, "No." Went up to that cell block, and he was on the table, and just ice cold, no pulse, no nothing, and he was dead. So we had to call the coroner in right away, and what it was, he died of pneumonia, which he had contacted from that. But can you imagine the I mean, here I'm trying to show him how we got these guys all cleaned up and gave them toothbrush and toothpaste and all that good thing, and the ones that then passed away. So that was a trying time. That was a scary time that those things happened. So I called the sheriff from Wayne County. I said, "Get these guys out of here. You know, you brought them here. You come on, get them into court and so on."
Was there any fear during the Detroit riots that it would spread or that it would spark something
Yes.
further out?
Yes. We were on 24-hour alert primarily. I had a tactical mobile squad, that tactical mobile unit that we adapted after Oakland County. And these men were specially trained in riots. And there wasn't a single deputy that was on that squad. It was a squad of 18 that was under 6 foot. And they wear special uniforms, okay? It was blue with tactical mobile unit on the side. And they were on a 24-hour alert. And a lot of times we had the guy stay right there at the jail because we felt – you could just feel the tension. You know, you just knew it was going to go on, and just praying like the devil that it didn't spread in the Ann Arbor area. Some of the blacks on Ann Street got a little rambunctious, okay? But nothing – nothing that really got carried away. Ann Arbor police handled that pretty good. They came in there and kind of squashed that before it really got started. They came down in front of the jail with a group and just hollering and shouting and not doing much of anything. And this is when we had Oakland County come in, and they come in and parked their cars in front of the jail, and they all got out their black uniforms, and they got out in regimental with their shotguns. And here's a group of black across the street, and they're shouting and so on. And this sergeant, and I'm watching this, and this sergeant says, "Lock and load." Oh, scared me, you know. But then all of a sudden, everybody just left. No interference or nothing. So that worked out. Power. It showed the strength. You know, and I think that kind of squashed it. But yeah, we were all pretty much aware that something might, hopefully not.
The FBI and J. Edgar Hoover felt that the John Sinclair and the White Panthers were a serious threat. And I'm just curious, did you agree then, and do you agree now? How do you feel about that now?
No, I don't think so. They were mostly talk, really. And John Sinclair, you know. That's when marijuana, and they'll say, "Boy, you smoke marijuana, you're going to jail." I mean, boom, boom. And he got nailed for, I think, 2 cigarettes, and he got 2 years in prison. Wow, God, you wouldn't even hear about today. You know, he writes you a ticket, you know, and you pay a fine, you know. And he was profiled, you know, and there was no question about it. But they made a lot of noise, but I really didn't have, you know, we were constantly aware of them and keeping close eye. And we had, and of course we had, Ann Arbor police had undercover people working with them and in that group. So we really had some real good tabs on them as far as, and just mostly talk about all they ever did. And today, you know, they would be not worth worrying about, really. I don't think, anyway. It's just a group of radicals that tried to get together and try to do some things, and they were for the marijuana, and they were for free love and, and all that kind of stuff. So.
Was there a need during this time for increased cooperation between the different law enforcement bodies and to figure out new ways that you would work together and coordinate in order to keep everything peaceful?
Yes, and I hope I'm answering it right, but I got great cooperation from Livingston County, Oakland County. Oakland County was the best. When I called for their help, my God, they sent us, I think it was 8 squad cars full of people and a big truck, and they sent me something like 35 or 40 men. Boy, when you call for that kind of help, you know, Livingston County says, "I can send you 2 deputies." I said, "Okay, that's 2 more than we got, you know." And some of the smaller departments, you know, and we had the other departments, Ann Arbor Police, and the cooperation was great. State Police was great; it was really great. But they were political, and they were told, you know, don't get involved in it unless they absolutely are needed. They did not get involved on the crowd up on East U. Parked their cars all up and down Washington Avenue. Bunch of police cars, you know, but no presence of them. I mean, they were there if we needed them. But I already had Oakland County. I had Monroe County sent me something like 20, 25 deputies. So the cooperation was great when you look back and see all the counties that cooperated. And basically, We had a command post, but I was sitting there being in command of all these units. So it was really a coordinated effort. And I was kind of proud, you know, to think that we could muster that many people and trained officers. Then you got some that get carried away, and, you know, you're sitting there training to watch 200 men. You can't do it. And especially with the I heard some group of guys said that they were sitting on their porch off in the area, and some of these deputies come by and threw tear gas at them. Whether it was true or not, I don't know. But again, I tried to find out who these deputies were. Well, Monroe County was down in that area. That's where their assigned area. Okay, so it was just an unfortunate, whether it was true or not, I don't know. But there were some unfortunate incidents where some of your deputies, and some of them would get, how would you word it, over exuberant, you know, I'm the police officer, I'm the badge. And I always try to instruct my men, don't ever let that badge do your talking. Represent yourself as a law enforcement officer, how you would want to be treated if you were on the other side of that guy. And didn't reach all of them. You know, there was a lot of times I had to take some disciplinary action against deputies who I found out. For example, there was one deputy. He was going to Ypsilanti in a patrol car, full uniform, broad daylight, Huron Street campus. And several students are up there and shouted, "Hey, pig." And he heard him. It was a nice afternoon. He stopped the patrol car, grabbed two of them by the back of the neck, threw them on the back of the trunk, and roughed them up. Didn't arrest them, roughed them up. And then said, "Don't you ever call me a pig again." Naturally, that phone of mine rang, and I said, "Oh, my God." So right away, I knew who the deputy was. I mean, I just knew who it was, and I said, "Bring him in." So he come in. And I said, "Did this happen?" He said, "Yep, it did." He said, "I just couldn't take any more of it." Experienced law enforcement officer. This officer came from the Ann Arbor Police Department, came onto my department, so he had years of experience. And I said, "Do you realize what you did?" He said, "Yes, I do." I said, "I've got to take disciplinary action against you. You know that?" And he said, "Yep, and I'm willing to take it." So I said, "Okay, I'm going to suspend you for 2 weeks without pay." And he says, "You know, I got a cabin up north. Good time to go up and do some work." I didn't reach him. I mean, other than he lost pay for 2 weeks. But he didn't ever do that kind of situation again. I think he put on a big show, that, you know, and really he was. I said, "Why didn't you arrest him? Why didn't you arrest him for disorderly person or and have some, rather than just rough him up?" And, you know, after I get you riffed up, you throw you back and say goodbye, and I'm going down this bad situation. But we didn't have many situations like that I could ever remember that I ever got involved in.
Well, that actually makes me kind of wonder about how the attitudes of the men in your department changed over the period of time that you were the sheriff. Did you see as your men would get increasingly frustrated with how things were going and how they were regarded by particularly the younger generation? Or did you have young officers coming in who were sympathetic to some of the beliefs of the countercultural people who were starting a lot of the things that,
no,
that you were dealing with?
To answer your question, for example, up on University, when we were up there, we stood in a line by the quad building there, standing there in line, and I told my men, "Don't make any action. The Ann Arbor police are handling this right now. We had some lock-ins and so on." And these students were going by and calling them pigs, spitting at my officers, and they were told not to move. That hurt, you know. And a lot of the boys really took offense to that. And, you know, it's something hard to say. "Well, boy, I remember when you did that. You know, I remember you doing that to me. And, Sheriff, when can we move? How much are we to take?" And then pretty soon I said, "I'm going to take you guys out of here. You know, we're not going to keep continuing taking this abuse unless the Ann Arbor police wanted us to be in there." And the NRA police said, "No, we got it under control." So I immediately took my men, and we left. Yeah, the attitude, it hung on for quite a while. But then after things settled down and we got back to our normal everyday police work, but then we had the Michigan murders going on. These guys were working tremendous hours. And then we had our governor at that time says, "Well, we're going to send in the state police because you can't solve the crime. We already had state police in there. I had already called for help. Hey, I need some help here. I need your investigative experience. I need the state police crime lab because we weren't capable of doing the things that the state police crime lab was capable of doing. So he just made a big grandstand for him at that. It was Milliken, man. I never forget him. But anyway, we were under a tremendous lot of strain. Our office, all of them were working over hours. Our overtime was killing us, and they were just getting. And it was hard to keep these guys, keep them down to what regular police work and so on. And I think they did a pretty good job. Yeah, I could see the attitudes changing. Yeah, and to try to keep them in tow was a difficult job, very definitely. And you can, it may have gotten you to settle down, but her, I couldn't, And then the next day, you would go on it. And it was just one of these things that would happen. The guys would talk. You could hear them talking in the squad room and so on. And I'd go down and talk to them, and I could hear, how much abuse are we to take?
You had some differences of opinion with Ann Arbor Police Chief Krasny. Can you talk about that a little bit?
No, Walt and I got along famously. Oh, yeah, I loved Walt Krasny. Walt Krasny gave me my driver's license when I was 14 years old. Now, I'm telling you, 14 years old, and Patrolman Walt Krasny gave me my road test. If you can imagine a kid 14 years old getting his license, now you got to be 16. 14 years old, driving my dad's 40 Ford, straight stick, okay? And here's a uniformed policeman sitting over there with the badge and the gun on. And you got a straight stick going up by the high school, going up on Huron Street in the state. I'll never forget it. The light turned red and I stopped, nervous, scared to death. And the light turned green and I let out in that clutch. And I thought, this is sure I failed. No, Walt Krasny and I had good working relationship. Walt, if you remember, was governed by the council. Now, a lot of things Walt Krasny couldn't do. I mean, he's a true policeman, believe me. And he graduated of the FBI Academy. And I had a lot of respect for Walt Krasny. And yet his hands were tied on a numerous occasion. And that's when I said, between him and I, secretly or behind the closed doors, he says, remember, Doug, you're the sheriff, and you have control of this whole county, including the city of Ann Arbor. He says, keep that in mind. And I knew what he was saying. I can't do this. I can't do this right now. I've got to back off a little water on it where I could. For example, the county building, when they sat at the county building, Ann Arbor police came down there, and Walt says, I can't help you. He says, that's county property. He said, you got to take care of it. I said, okay. They were students and that. So we thought maybe the Ann Arbor police should come down. Well, they came down with their cameras and so on, but made no arrests and so on. So we had to make all the arrests in the county building. And there was a situation there where they were sitting in the hall. And Judge Brakey was there at that time. And Judge Brakey said, I want them out of my hallways. I want them out. So we start dragging them out. And now my deputies, at that time, they were using a lot of vigilance. They were two on this arm and two on the leg, using four deputies, carrying one at a time. And I got up there and I said, stop that. You're not going to treat them like they're babies. I said, drag them out of there by their feet if they won't stand up and walk out. And they weren't. They weren't going to sit. They were sitting like there. Well, they were on the second floor. And if you remember, them steps going down were cement. Now, once they hit about the second or third cement, they said, stop, we'll walk. they snapped it. So that ended that. We then were able to get everybody out of there. And that was when I seen them carrying them, I said, no, we're not going to do that. Start pulling them out. And the deputies loved that, grabbing their foot. But that was comical when you see them. And nobody got hurt. I mean, it's just that, their feelings got hurt and their back got hurt. But other than that, no. No, I don't think we had any. Walt and I never had any disagreements that I can never recall. I really can't. And I don't know where that ever came from because the cooperation we got from when I would have a departmental meeting, I would want all my men at the departmental meeting. Well, it's kind of hard when you got three shifts going. And so I asked, Walt, could you patrol the county for me? We'll deputize your men in our cars, because their radio was with our radio anyway, and while we have a meeting. And he says, yeah. And the Ann Arbor police loved it. Oh, you get to go outside the county, go outside the city of Ann Arbor and be a county sheriff. So those things were that we did together.
Your department and your reputation was also used by the Ann Arbor police and other police forces as a threat at times. You were like, I read somewhere about at West Park, they said to them, we'll call the sheriff. Do you want us to call the sheriff? I'm going to calm them right down. You know?
Oh, I never heard that.
Oh, yeah?
No, I never heard that.
Yeah, I read that somewhere.
I like it, but never. this was, like I say, we had a lot of the groups that were meeting, and they met with the Ann Arbor police on numerous occasions. We're going to have a group meet. You know, it's going to be peaceful and so on. Some of them may get carried away. Now, they met with the Ann Arbor police and told them this. But please, don't call the sheriff. We want just you guys. You know, we just want you guys there. And that's when Krasny said, you know, I can't guarantee this, okay? As long as you keep it peaceful and we can handle this and contain it and so on, we will go along with this. But once it gets carried away, and if he moves, meaning me, I have no control over him, nor can I stop him. And that was the same thing that the prosecutor told Fleming. And when Fleming made this comment up there, and the prosecutor says, he is the sheriff, chief law enforcement officer of this county, and he acts on his own authority.
Over the course of the 60s, did you ever feel like you were losing the support of the people of the county, or is it just that the vocal minority who didn't like what you were doing were getting louder?
No, I didn't. I thought I had strong support of the county. And let me tell you why. When I was invited, and I was a Democrat, as you know, first Democrat to be elected in Washington County's history, and I was the second youngest sheriff in the state of Michigan to be elected, 32 years old, you know, and a former police officer of Ipsy. But I was invited to the Jack Daniels supper, the Republican dinner. Now, when this certain individual asked me, would you come to that dinner? I says, well, that's all Republicans. I said, you know, he said, we really want you there. I got a standing ovation when I went there. That to me said, oh, my gosh, you know, politics be darned. And so, yeah, the support I had, I think, in the county was just great. But I think it just got the betterment of me. I was young and to the point where I was getting some advice from people, getting bad advice. For example, after my second term, changing parties, okay? Because the Democratic Party, we had the Democratic Party in Ann Arbor, somewhat radical, okay? And the Democratic Party in Ypsilanti, boom, you know, completely different, you know? Put them in jail, lock them up, so on. Ann Arbor, no, let's don't do this. Why are your men wearing helmets? We think that's offensive, Democratic Party in Ann Arbor. I said, because of the safety. We had roll bars put in there, and they had helmets put on for the officer safety. Well, they didn't want that. Then they didn't want the jail where we had housed prisoners that you couldn't control, which we called at that time was the hole. And it was. But we didn't have any place else to put these people who were such that we had no control over. We couldn't put them in a cell because of injuring themselves and so on. And one guy, and I keep getting into myself, but I don't want to get away from that, but one guy couldn't control him at all. He was just a bad actor. So we put a straitjacket on him, and we put him in there. And I said, now, this will calm you down. I did this, okay? I said, this will calm you down. I personally put that jacket on him. You get out of that jacket, and I'll let you out of there. We put him in that hole. We come up. We started going up the steps, and we heard on the cell door. I says, can't be. Went back down there, opened that cell buck, and he handed me the straitjacket. Honest to God, I said, oh, boy, you're really trying my patience now. So we, this guy was a real mental. And at that time, we had a hard time getting him out to the Ipsy State Hospital. We had a big black fella, Alex Pope. He was 6 foot six, 240 pounds, big. And he would go really bunkers. So we put him what we called a mental cell. It was wire caged and so on. It only housed one person. We put him in there, hoping to calm him down. And he had worked that metal cage. He had worked a piece of that metal off, had it in his hand. Now, the next day, we're going to transport him to Ipsy State Hospital. We finally got the okay. So my captain come up and he says, you better give us some help. He said, because this is a big man and he ain't going peacefully. So we had three deputies and myself, and I said, I know Alex real well. I said, let me talk to him, okay? And there's a opening in the hole where you pass the food and so on. So I got down there, and I said, and I had a pair of handcuffs sitting in my pocket. I had my shirt on, you know, suit and tie. Alex, I said, look, I said, we're going to take you to the hospital. I said, give me your hand. Let's shake hands on it. Okay, Sheriff, he said. And he put that big old paw out there. And I mean, man, it was covering me like this. And when he did, I slapped that handcuff on him. And then I grabbed the other cuff and I said, okay, open the door. Boy, when they opened that door, he come out with his other hand and he slashed my shirt right down here with that piece of wire. Them guys finally grabbed him. Now, it took five of us to get him down and to put cuffs on him and cuff his feet and so on. My deputies took him to the state hospital, and when he got there, they said, okay, take the stuff off. And he says, hey, took five of us to put him in this thing. You give him a shot first. So these are some of the things that we had to go through, and I had to agree with them, you know. But what was I to do? I was in a position where I have a bad actor prisoner, and I had no other conveniences, none whatsoever, what to do with them. We didn't keep him in there for long other than the fact, because the majority of people would just calm right down. So we had fights on that. So then I got some people telling me, well, you know, you ought to change parties. Get rid of that Democratic Party because they're just not doing you any good and so on. And I said, okay, because I was the biggest vote getter in the county. I was bigger than anybody, you know. I thought, well, heck, if I change, people are going to do this. They're not. People are used to the two-party system. No matter what you say or what you do or how strong you are. I know it now after the years, you know. They are not going to look in an independent or write-in, anything like that. This is why they can't get that, you know, other parties. And they're going to go, and I've had many people tell me, hey, I'm a Republican, but I switched for you. And it just didn't work. It was a bad deal. And I was kind of relieved at the time because I was really getting, you know, really getting to my point where I was getting wore out. I really was. So that was the end of that story.
The Democratic candidate in 1972 was your undersheriff, Harold Owings. Did you have a difference of opinion with Harold Owings? What made him decide to run against you?
Yeah, Harold Owings. Let me tell you. Harold Owings was, and I tell him to this day, was a rat. And I never knew this. And everybody kept trying to tell me, you know, you got the wrong man in there. He's stabbing you in the back. Well, I couldn't believe that. Not my second in command. No way in the world. So we had a meeting. And I said, Harold, I got an idea. Why don't you run for sheriff? And then we run in the Republican Party. I'll run in the Democratic Party. Irregardless of which one of us get elected, the other one will be the undersheriff. He says, good idea. He said, we'll do that. And I says, that way we can keep our same regime going. We can keep this thing intact, and we don't have to change anything. Because as soon as you change sheriffs, things change. Personnel change, attitudes change, and it did when I first took office too. And I made some real basic changes I had to right away. But anyway, Then I had one of my men who did it on his own, went to Eastern Michigan, where Harold Owings gave a speech to the young students down there. And one of the questions was, one of the students raised her hand and said, "What are you going to do with Harvey? Are you going to keep him?" And he said, "Under no condition am I ever going to keep that man." Got back to me right away, and I was homesick at the time when I remember this. And I got on the phone, and I told Harold, "Come out to the house." In the meantime, I told my captain, "You bring him out." So he come out. Come out to my house, and I says, "You're fired." I says, "You're a rat. Why did you turn against him?" "I didn't do that." And I said, "Harold, yes, you did." And from then on, he just, so that was our, just never found out. And it seemed like every undersheriff that I had wanted to be sheriff. They wanted that second spot. The first guy I had, I took Don Bobo, who was an ex-state trooper. And Don didn't have no animosity or anything, but he wasn't really well. And Don could only last, he lasted about 6 months, and he said, "Doug, I got to go. I can't." He was my real, true, trustworthy undersheriff. As you can imagine, he's second in command, you know. And so I appointed a good friend of mine, man that I worked for when I was a deputy. He was a sergeant, Claire LeFerrier, made him my undersheriff. And lo and behold, after a year and there or whatever, he turned against me too, because he kept telling one of my deputies, I think it was with a funeral. One of my deputies had gotten killed. And he made the comment to some of the people that I'm the one that set up this thing, and Harvey can never do things like this. And it was really knocking me down, you know. So I called him in my office, and I said, "Did you say these things? You know, politically, it's and he says, "Give me a chance to resign." I said, "Okay, you resign now, effective immediately." You know, he wanted to be sheriff. Come from sergeant to an undersheriff, you know, boy, funnel from sergeant to captain, then to undersheriff. So that really, and then the next guy, same thing, you know. I kept thinking, where do these guys want, you know, you want the seat so bad, go ahead and run for it, you know. But you always want to have your second in command as a trustworthy individual.
Looking just at your career, you had, as the sheriff, you have to deal with the politics on all the different levels. You have to deal with the press. You have to deal with all kinds of different people in the community. I got to ask, why would anyone ever want to be sheriff?
I don't know. You know, I wish I could tell you. You know, that's true, because you're in a hell of a spot. You really are. You got the politics. You got the parties, the Republican Party, the Democratic Party. You got the press. When we had the Michigan murders, boy, the Detroit Free Press hammered us. Oh boy, we were Keystone Cops and one thing after another. So when I would have a press conference, I barred the Free Press. Oh boy, that made them mad. I mean, they came to the jail and I had the Ann Arbor News in there, and we had all the rest of the press. And here's the two guys from the Free Press, and my deputy was at our door in my office. He says, "You can't go in, it's full." He said, "Well, we're the Free Press." He said, "You especially can't go in." And so one guy said, "You can't do that." I said, "I just did it." Got a lot of flack. but I did things my way. I made a statement that I was probably the worst politician in the world, but the best sheriff. And politics I didn't play. I wouldn't play politics because in the old days, when I was a deputy, if you arrested somebody, for example, I arrested you and you were a good friend of Sheriff Peterson, you didn't go to jail. I had to release you. And I remember an incident when my deputy and I, Tom Hill, we arrested this Frank DePalma. He owned at that time the dairy over in Ypsilanti. Big contributor to Peterson. Drunk. He had called us at this bar, so we got there, and Al Hill says, We got to take him home. I said, he's drunk. And he's raising Cain in this bar. He's a disorderly person. I said, I'm going to arrest him. He says, it ain't going to work. I said, yes, it is. I arrested him, put him in that patrol car, took him all the way to Ann Arbor Jail, okay, because we said Ypsilanti. In 2 hours, he was out. Made me feel, I said, I'll never do that again. So from then on, we had a different attitude. We may want to arrest you, maybe we didn't want to. If you told me you was a sheriff's friend, I'd say, okay, go on. You know, why go through with that? Why get it? Why do the embarrassment? And I vowed when I got in the sheriff's office that would never happen. Never, never happen. And there was a couple of incidents where some contributors to my campaign was arrested in Ypsilanti. And they said, this was about 11 o'clock at night, and they were drunk. My deputies arrested them. And they said, call the sheriff. So they called me at 11 o'clock at night, and I came out, went down and met my deputies, and they told me what happened. The guy was drunk, this so on. And he said he's a big – and they didn't know right then. I was pretty new, okay? Really, I think they're really trying to feel me out. You know, what is this guy going to do? We heard what he said, but is he going to do it? So I says, look, gentlemen, you arrested him. You go ahead and go through with it, okay? If you want to turn him over to me, I'll take him home. But I said, you can probably take his car in because he's drunk. And if you want to follow through with the charges, you can go ahead and do so. Or if you want to go over to the jail, go ahead and book him. Go ahead and do it. They says, you know, we'll decide. We're going to talk about it. And I like that. I really did, you know. You are telling us we're going to. And consequently, they says, we're going to impound his car and we're going to give him a ticket for speeding. And we'll let you take him home. But and they took, the guy standing right there, he says, don't ever, ever do this again. The deputy's telling him. So we put him in the car and I took him home. But the next day, you know, he called me up and he says, you know, it's going to cost me $60 to get my car out. I said, you're lucky you aren't in jail.
I want to follow up on Andrew saying who would want to be sheriff. I have a question. I read that you grew up in Observatory Lodge here in Ann Arbor. And
yes, I did.
I'm curious about your childhood, your young years, and is there a point at which you knew you wanted to go into law enforcement? Do you recall?
I went into the service. Let me tell you real quickly. My folks moved to California, okay? At the age of 15, I was going to high school, and me and this other fella decided we wanted to go into the Navy. Can't go into the Navy. You got to be 17. And he says, no, I got a friend who will give us phony birth certificates. At 15 years old, we joined the Navy. Went to boot camp San Diego. My folks were just, you know, didn't want it, but I said, I'm going to do it or else I'll run away. You know, I was just that kind of a kid at that time. And as soon as boot camp got all over, 16 weeks, the chief called me in and says, hey, how old are you? And I said, 17. He said, no, you're not. You're 15. We got your record. We're going to discharge you. Now, in that days, they were discharging the people, and they were given a gold eagle on their shoulder, showing that you were a veteran, okay? And they gave me one of these. When I went back to high school, I was allowed to carry cigarettes because I was a veteran. So I carried cigarettes for the other guys. So anyway, I had to decide, well, I've got to get through school. This is not going to go. I'm going to go back in the Navy when I get old enough. And I did. I rejoined the Navy when I got out of school, high school. And then when I came back out of the Navy, I got a job at King Sealy. That wasn't for me. Boy, you know, being in that factory and doing this, we were doing scopes for the military, procedure stuff. And boy, this was not, I just couldn't handle this. I think I worked about a week. And I told him, I said, no, I can't stand coming into this plant and checking in with the clock and so on. I got to do something else. So I come out and I joined the, luckily I got on the Ann Arbor Fire Department. I was a fireman. Made $4,300 a year, but we all worked part-time on our day off, okay? After the fire department, there was an ad in the paper with the Ypsilanti police, one of the police officers. I said, that's what I want to be. That's what I was going to do. So I went down there and applied, and got hired and became a police officer, and that's when I decided. And then, again, back in those days, now this is in '50s, no education, no training. And you know how they trained me? Reading police reports while I'm waiting for my uniform to come. After a week, my uniforms came. Didn't ask me if I knew how to shoot a gun or nothing. Never showed me how to use handcuffs. No. And I strapped this thing on and this, and I said, you know what? This is ridiculous. I taught myself. Okay? And I thought, you know, this kind of thing can. After I was a police officer for 1 year, they sent me to Michigan State University to the police administration course, which was a month course, teaching you how to do things and how to crime scene. I thought, God, I'm already indoctrinated in this, and I already knew this, but I just loved it. So I got myself a set of law books, and I studied, and I studied, and I studied. And I can remember the sergeant one day called me in off the road, and I was just a patrolman. He's a sergeant, called me in off the road. He said, we got a situation here, Doug. I want to know what you think. These two guys were having booze, and they did this and did that and so on. Do we have enough to charge them with minor possessions? They were in a car. We didn't see them, but they got the booze there. And I said, yeah, you got enough evidence there. You got the booze? Yeah, enough evidence to charge them. They used to call me in all the time wanting to know about this and about that as far as what the law was. So the city attorney and I became real close friends, Ken Bronson. I'll never forget him as long as I live. And his first 2 days, we had to go to circuit court. And Ken Bronson, being an attorney with Judge Brakey's court, would put his leg under his chair and sit on his leg. And I says, Ken, don't do that. Put your legs down. Oh, okay. I had to instruct him how to act in a court. This was no kidding. And so then I went. People called me up, and I was not in the Democratic Party. I mean, I just didn't go to no meetings or anything. But a friend of mine, Chuck Gray, who was running for state representative. You remember?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And called me up and says, Doug, we're putting together a real good party. And we got West Vivian, Congress, and I forget who else was. But anyway, they had this. We want you to run for sheriff. And I says, what? And I says, my God, I can't. There's no way in the world I can make. Yes, you can. He can be beat. So I said, well, if I do it, I'm going to go all the way, you know, the hog wild with it. And I did. And did a lot of investigation. And the proof's in the pudding. I beat my old boss, George Peterson. And I remember the day before the election, Peterson came out with a spread in the Ann Arbor News. Do you want a race driver for your sheriff? Because I was racing cars. And here's his police record. You know, I think I had two traffic tickets, and he made sure he blasted them. But those days, like I said, and I had just vowed that, you know, if I was going to do this, and I had, like I said, I did some studying on the law. And one thing I made sure of, I said, when I get into that sheriff department, and I vowed to everybody that I was going to change it drastically. I mean, there was patrol cars that they had to take handcuffs and put it around the doors, keep the door from flying open. They would never get new cars. So as soon as I got in there, three of the cars, we jumped immediately. We just had to junk them immediately. And I got emergency funding to get police cars. But then I started the first recruit school of Washtenaw County's history, training deputies. They were going to know how to use a gun. They were going to go to a firing range. They were going to know when to use a pair of handcuffs and how to put a pair of handcuffs on so that it didn't, cut into their skin and so on. There's a lot to it. And they were going to study law. And I put together the prosecutor come down and conducted a couple of classes. I had Michigan State troopers coming in conducting some classes. So I got vast people coming in and helping me out. And so we did real well with that. And then I got new cars and new concepts, and it was going good. I was getting very proud. We had to change the records, for one thing. The way the records were, they would just put it in a regular file. You may look in the assault file and see some rapes, or you may see attempted murder, all in one file. Well, you can't have that. You know, you got Ypsilanti police taught me that. They had everything filed separately, the rapes, the assaults, and so on. You have to do that if you're going to do some checking. So they helped me develop new record system.
Well, I wanted to ask about – there was some talk, I think it was in 1970, about you running for Congress, and then you opted to not do that.
Yes.
Why did you make that decision?
I didn't want that, no part of that. That's politics. I hated politics. I hated it with a passion. I didn't mind going out and giving speeches. I didn't mind that. I didn't mind going out and talking and so on. But to sit, you know, and I talked to Wes Vivian, and I knew what he went through. And you're going to go to Washington and this type of thing. And number one, I didn't think I could ever make it. I didn't think I had the educational background for it. I really didn't. Because you got to be a little more smarter than I was with just a high school education to be a congressman, you know. And I thought it would just make a fool of myself. And again, didn't want no part of it because I know you're going to be deeply involved in politics. And like I say, I hated politics. I really, really did hate politics. It was just so many times when politics would try to intervene with me, and I would balk, right? You know, you just don't tell me what to do. You know, don't dare tell me what to do. I'm obeying the law. I'm going to do my duties as I see fit. But when you come in there and start saying, you are going to do this, not will you, you are going to do this. And the only time I think I played politics was when I had those prisoners. That time I played politics. I said, boy, I'm going to get blasted, sure. So I want these three influential people, black, to see what was going on. And then, unfortunately, I had a death.
I wanted to ask you about the incidents with the students that sued you for cutting their hair. Can you talk about that?
Oh, God. You would do that. You would do that. As you know, the long hair was in. I mean, that was the thing. They had hair long as you. All the men did. And to me, that was not cool. You know, you had to be. I just always associated them with the hippie movements. Okay, and so these three individuals got arrested. Okay. And when they came into the jail, and the one they were coming down for, I forget what it was now, but anyway, they were coming down, I think, to bail somebody out or do something in there or whatever it was, but they were causing such a commotion, and one of them had the American flag sewed on his butt upside down. So when I come out of my office and I spotted that, I said, throw him in the jail, lock him up, and the other two start causing trouble, disorderly. Throw them in too. Lock them up too. I said, okay. So I went over to the prosecutor. And again, knowing the law, a lot as I did, and don't get me wrong, Bill Delahaye, probably one of the best prosecutors this county ever had. Anyway, I got over there and I told him what I did. And he says, what are you getting them on? I says, got to be a law on that, Bill. And he says, boy, I don't know what it is. I said, just grating the flag. And he says, I think you're right. So when they got to the jail and had them arraigned and they were given 4 days, 5 days in jail or what it was, under my recommendation to the judge, what do you want? Give them 5 days. They were getting haircuts. Now, I did not have a barber. And this one guy said he was a barber. And come to find out, he was not a barber, okay? So he took them, and I mean, the dandruff was higher than their hair, believe me. I mean, he just shaved. And then they found out that this guy who did the haircut was a convicted murderer going to Jackson Prison. He was awaiting transfer to Jackson Prison. So they took us to federal court. I was a crew cut. Always wore a crew cut. The prosecutor, I didn't think I'd ever forget his name. Loved him. I loved him. Another crew cut. Here are two crew cut guys who are in the federal court. Now, these guys, their hair has grown out now, about the same as ours. And the thing come out was in the paper was the fact that the difference between a good haircut and a bad haircut is only 3 days. And I made that comment. The Michigan Barbers Association got together and gave me a plaque as the honorary barber of the year. But anyway, that cost the county $600 a piece. Very expensive haircut. But since then, after that, I obtained a barber, a licensed regular barber, and we had a barber because everybody got a haircut. And Louis Sell, I'll never forget him. Louis Sell was the attorney. Louis Sell represented a lot of the who were the radicals? And then I can't think. The subversive individuals. And when he got up there, got me on the stand, he says, why do you do that? I said, this is for sanitary reasons. We want to make sure they don't bring in lice and so on for our jail and so on. And he'll never forget this. And he said, if the Lord came into your jail, would you shave his head? And I said, I don't expect the Lord to ever be coming to my jail. And I mean, he made me answer that. I mean, he specifically, and the judge wouldn't do nothing about it. And I said, well, if it were the case, which is stupid, but I said, yes, he would have his hair cut. Never forget that.
What did you think of that, of the argument that they made that their hair was part of the expression of what they were and what they believed in? And...
Oh, I didn't think much of it. I just shunned it off. You know, just one of those things that I can recall that we were down. I didn't like them, for example, because of the way they dressed. I guess that was really, they were, it seemed like everyone, not all of them. Now, there were some decent individuals that just decided to let their hair grow. And still today, you still see some of them. So I think nothing about it, but I look at them in a different way than I do with the way we are. And but we were downtown Ann Arbor and had a parade going by. And I was standing there. I forget where I was, but I was standing on the corner of Washington, I think Main Street. And there was a young man, long-haired, standing with his buddy. And as the American flag went by, he gave a finger. Oh, I seen red. I grabbed them both right by the collar. Arrested them. Again, don't know what I arrested them for. But we took them down, but we let them go, you know, because I really didn't have any charge on them. But I don't know. It always seemed like the ones that were causing us the problems were the long hairs. And yet, like I say, there were some that we seen that they were not at. So you couldn't really say every long hair was bad. And this is the thing we had to see, make sure that everybody understood. But we did look at them differently. I don't care who you were, you know. You could have been a suit and a tie and so on and had long hair, and I still look at you differently. That's just my bringing up, I guess, and the way we were taught. I have to be honest with you, you know.
Can you just talk a little bit about the great UFO chase in 1966?
Oh, my God. I got a call from England, and it's hard to understand them guys, you know. And he says, Sheriff, I want to talk to you about the UFOs. And I says, my gosh. He said, we're doing a documentary on the UFOs. I says, okay. He said, the Manor people. And I says, all right. We got a call that the Manor's out in Dexter seeing a UFO. So I went out there with a couple of, and the grass was down flat in a round circle, big, wide rounds, quite large. And they said they'd definitely seen an object come down and then lift off. These are respectable people. They're not nuts. They're not trying to make money or anything. And they really didn't want us to use their name because they didn't want the publicity. So as soon as we made the report, of course, the news got a hold of that, and boy, that was just boom. Too bad it was already out. A Professor Hynek came to our jail, and he introduced himself. He said, I'm from Washington, and I come down to inspect that site about the UFO. I said, okay. So I drove him out there. And he looked at it, and he looked at it and talked to the manners, and he got back in the car. I says, what do you think? He says, you know, I really don't know. I really don't know. He says, something was there. Got back to the jail, and as soon as we got back to the jail, he had a call from Washington. I said, well, you can take it in my office. He says, okay. So he went in my office. 20 minutes later, he comes out of my office. He says, and the press was there. Okay. Soon they come in the office. He says, we have definitely discovered that it was swamp gas. Washington. Okay. All of a sudden coming up, I don't know what it is, but now all of a sudden it's swamp gas. And that's where it died. And there was a fellow, I think up in Brighton, that had observed a flying object. And there's some articles in the paper, I'm sure, that pilots, airplane pilots had seen this, had seen the various items and so on. So these fellows from England, I guess, are coming here, and they're going to do a documentary, and they told me that they would be coming here and so on. And again, you know, I have to believe the manners. I mean, really, I really couldn't. And everybody said to me, well, what do you think? I said, I don't know. I didn't see it. I know I didn't see the grass. And it was kind of hard to say that, why would that particular grass be in a circle? Swamp gas. How can this really be? You know. So I was very skeptical on that.
You talked a little bit about John Norman Collins, but I'm wondering if you could walk us through that story a little bit more. And I'm particularly interested in a couple aspects of it, like when it became apparent that one person was committing these crimes, and also how it worked with all the different law enforcement agencies working together and things happening in various jurisdictions and having to bring people in from outside.
It basically happened all in Washington County. Yeah. So, you know, we were it. And then we brought, you know, we asked state police to come in. And we got two men from Ypsilanti Police Department because we had a city of Ypsilanti. We had two men from the Ann Arbor Police Department. I assigned two deputies from the Sheriff's Department. And then we had, I think, four from the Michigan State Police. And that was the squad. They set up a different – I'm going to tell you something about that in a minute, as you brought that up. And it worked good. I mean, they were really working together. And John – my two detectives were on John Norman Collins. His name came up, and boy, they just kept ringing a bell, you know. And all of a sudden, and I forget how it was, but anyway, Bill Mulholland was one of my detectives. He said, I think we got enough to bring this guy in and talk to him. Well, then that's when all the hellabaloo broke out, and then it was shortly after that we did arrest John Norman Collins, okay? And I took – you remember the beauty operator on Heron Street who said that this young individual took this girl and put her on his motorcycle and drove off? That's when she was killed, okay? That was the young girl. And I took pictures over to her. And I had John Norman Collins and five other ones, and she picked John Norman Collins right out of that. So we had a pretty good case going as far as this going. Now, when we started gathering all the evidence that we had, okay, primarily, you know, we knew we had blood stains, okay, we had the motorcycle, we had some other evidence that we could not use in court. Basically, what we convicted him on was circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence. But we knew in our hearts, this was our man. Now, all of a sudden, the murder stopped. Did the murderer move away, or what happened? This kid, I did a little background on him, and I went up to Dr., I can't think of his name, about the Ipsy State Hospital. And talked to him, a psychiatrist, and says, you know, what kind of an individual are we looking for? I said, boy, I'm going crazy here. You know, this guy is committing these murders, and it's always after a rainfall, okay? And every, unbeknowing, and if you know this or not, but every girl that we found would have either a twig or a screwdriver or something shoved up her vagina, slashes on her breast, and each one had a long, dangly, pierced earring, each single one. And each one was in their menstrual period. We had a young lady who went to Eastern Michigan University. We found her, and she went out with John. Very nice gentleman, she says, except when he took me home. When we got to the doorstep, he says, you don't have to go in right away, do you? And she says, well, yeah, I do, because I got to study and whatever it may be. And she said, he made the comment to me, you're in your menstrual period, aren't you? Because I can smell it. Weird kid. Now, these, again, this, what does this mean? You know, this doesn't make him a murderer, okay? And so when we start talking to him, he was just, well, nothing to do with this. I called him down in my office. I was the sheriff. Called him down in my office. And I said, John, I'm going to tell you something. Going to Jackson Prison is not going to be no treat for you. They're going to make a lady out of you in about 10 minutes as soon as you get up there in prison. We can help you. You're a sick individual. We can help you, get you to a mental hospital where you can get some psychiatric help. But I can't give it to you unless you cooperate with us. He started crying. And he says, okay, I'll tell you everything. Boy, my heart was going 100 miles an hour. I said, no, you wait. Sit right here. So I got on the phone, called the prosecutor. This was 10 o'clock at night. Doug, you can't talk to him. You're in charge of the case. I said, yes, I can. I'm the sheriff. And he's in my jail. And he's got a problem. So I'm talking to him. And he wants to talk to me. He said, okay, get a stenographer over there right away. In the meantime, he says, call Lewis Sell, the attorney. This took about an hour. Get the prosecutor there, the stenographer, and Lewis Sell. Lewis Sell says, I want to talk to my client. I said, go into my office. He went into his office in there 45 minutes. And he come out and he says, go ahead and talk to him. I'll see you. Got in the car and left. We went in there. John was very composed and so on. We got the stenographer, Delahaye, and myself. And he says, yes, we did steal that trailer. Because it was a trailer stolen, taken to California. I said, oh, my God, how they got him calmed right down. He was going to take a polygraph test before Lewis Sell got into this. There was a guy called Smokey Ryan, Neil Ryan. Great attorney, just a heck of a nice guy. He was John's first attorney. So Smokey said, can you set up a polygraph test over in the courthouse? We says, yes. So we set up a polygraph test for a polygraph operator. We had guards all around. Stan Burdine and I took him across the street. We had to walk him across the street from the jail. It was raining that night, you know, kind of a misty rain, like all the murders were committed. John was just shaken. He wasn't himself, you know. We could just tell something was really bothering him. We got him over to the jail, or got him over to the courthouse, and Ryan was there with him, naturally. And he said, before my client takes the test, I want to talk to him. So Ryan took him in this one room, and they talked, and they talked, and they talked. Come out, Ryan says, take him back. We're not going to do a polygraph. I know for a fact John Norman Collins told him everything, because the next day Smokey Ryan was fired by his mother. Smokey Ryan was one of these guys that, I'm going to defend you, but you got to be truthful with me. You know, if you did this, then you got to tell me, and I'll work my best magic to get whatever we can. I know him that well. And Smokey was a drinker. We used to take him out and pump booze into him, you know. I said, now, hey, Smokey, between us, what did he tell you? Never would tell us. Never would tell us to this day. But that was one of the things that primarily happened, that we just knew for a fact. And I had the chance to go on to, you remember Channel 7, I think, with Marilyn Turner and her husband. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. But anyway, they had this program, and they wanted me to come down and talk about the Michigan murders. Delahaye didn't want to go. So he said, you go. I said, okay. So I went. So I was put in this little green room before going on the air. This is television now. And there was this lady sitting there. She says, you're the sheriff. I said, yeah. She says, well, I'm so-and-so. I'm John Norman Collins' confidant. I said, okay, that's nice. She says, you got the wrong man. There is no way in God's creation he could have possibly committed these crimes. I said, why did all the crimes stop? I said, do you know what kind of a case they had in California on him? She says, oh, that was bad too. I said, ma'am, John Norman Collins killed a girl in California. And then he, when he dumped her body, it was in poison ivy. He went to the hospital that night with the poison ivy. The sweater he was carrying had her pubic hairs in it. So California had a better case. We was hoping California would take him because they had the execution there, okay? So there was just no question about it. I hope I answered, you know, your things. But the things that we had on him, it was just he's a sick individual. I told you I did a little background on him. His mother was a prostitute. When she came into the courtroom, now with John Norman Collins, we took him over to court, shirt and tie, clean cut. I'm a good-looking kid, and you look at him, you say, geez, I wouldn't mind my daughter going out with him. I mean, just with his appearance alone. His mother walked in, long dangly earrings, miniskirt up to here. She was a knockout. I mean, believe me, she was an attractive woman. And also his sister, who was with her, another beautiful girl. I mean, she was beautiful. Everybody just looked because both of them had their miniskirts. Both of them had their long, dangly ears. And through some of our studies and some of the things that I learned, I had found out that John had caught his mother with a John. And supposedly, and when I talked to the psychiatrist, he says, we have an individual here who supposedly has a mother instinct that is driving him to kill. This is what the psychiatrist told me. Still, again, didn't give me any clues or anything, you know, but it gave me an idea of what kind of an individual we're looking for with everything that this kid he did. And then when you've seen that mother and that daughter, you know, and both of them had, I don't know if it's significant or not, both of them had their earrings and the long dangly earrings. When he, of course, when he went to Jackson Prison, he tried to get transferred to Canada, and we squashed that. They couldn't, they wouldn't take him, or they wouldn't let him out of Jackson for it. And he's made several attempts to escape.
So you came into the department, you instituted reforms. You did things like speaking to a psychiatrist when you were trying to track down a serial killer. Did you regard yourself at the time, and do you regard yourself now, were you a progressive law enforcement officer, or did you regard what you did as traditional police work like had been done for decades?
No, I think I was progressive. I feel that way. I want to think that. I really do. I did things that were done before. I would do something differently because it didn't work and there's something wrong here. So I thought, well, I explore some other avenues. There's got to be something else. And I went to that psychiatrist by myself. I said, gee, maybe he can show some light on me. What kind of an individual? And I had an hour talk with him, which was, and then I come back and shared it with the rest of the guys and so on. But after we got John arrested and got the motorcycle and the blood types and all this type of thing, as we got him convicted, there was one thing about Louis Sell. They're going to get me on the stand, and it was word came back to me. He's going to really grill you. You're really going to get it. I had been in a motorcycle accident and I had broke my leg, so I was in a wheelchair. Louis L. changed his mind because he said the sympathy from the jury of him sitting in that wheelchair wasn't going to work. So he didn't have me on very long at all. Got me right off. So his plan kind of backfired on him. But Louis L. was an attorney who defended a lot of the Communist Party people. And this is and him and his can't think of his other attorney, the one that finally did the – you remember his name? I can't think. But anyway, they were in the in one of the restaurants in the club, and one of my deputies who was also there overheard him saying, Louis L. was in charge. He says, if you lose this case, which I think you're going to, if you lose this case, find another law firm. He lost it, and he did find another law firm. So that's what happened.
Do you view yourself as, when you look at how you were as a sheriff, do you feel that you were more interested in just maintaining law and order, or did you actually feel that, you know, the hippies, for instance, were, you know, wrecking the moral fabric of our society? Did you feel like you had an obligation to do something at that level, or were you just mostly just concerned about maintaining?
No, I was always maintaining about keeping law enforcement, keeping a good department, keeping a clean department, and making sure that the things we did were within realms of the law. I was really advocate about that. I was bound and determined. I used to go out on every fatal accident. That was my order. You call me on every fatal accident. I would make sure that I'd go out on every fatal accident. Not that I didn't trust my deputies, but I wanted to see the scene myself and see if there was some way that we could prevent some things, some knowledge, okay? Don Hawkey, University of Michigan, he was doing a study on fatal accidents, and he had a grant from the government. And I would go out with him, and this guy was fabulous. And we had a suicide by car. Was on Territorial Road. This man, him and his wife, had gotten into a dispute or an argument or whatever it was. And he took off, and about a half a mile down, he picked out the biggest tree there was and hit it head on. How we proved, Don Hawkey did, and I was with him, and I learned so many things. Number one, took his shoe. He said, I want to see this shoe. He never had the imprint of the brake pedal on that shoe. The other shoe had the imprint of the gas pedal. So he said, I'm telling you, he was gassing it. Now he took the light bulb out of the brake bike, and he says, you see the filament here? Had he hit the brakes, that filament would be like this. The filament was like this, meaning it busted from the force. And so then he taught, he would have meetings with law enforcement officers. And he would show all these films on the fatal accidents, locking your car doors. How many people, now of course, you know, cars lock automatically. How many people would not lock their door? The door not being locked would automatically fly open, and people would get tossed out. And then he would show us films where people who had seatbelts, that's when seatbelts were really coming in prevalent then, and had you not had your seatbelt on, we had one person who caterpillared in the car, and that caused the death. Had they had their seatbelt on, he says, that car, there's plenty of room to live. They could have lived. And there was so much things that we learned by that guy, and I was always fascinated with him. So from the knowledge I picked up from him, I was gaining when going out to the fatal accidents. I recall an accident that I went to on Whitmore Lake Road. This lady had hit the embutment. The emergency brake had gone through her leg. It was right through her leg. And she was sitting there screaming, but she was alive. And the wrecker drivers were there, and they said, Jesus, we can't get her out of this car. I said, okay. And I did this. And I said, give me your wrecker. They got the cable, and I hooked it around this thing. And I said, now I'm going to tell you something, driver. When I give you the signal, you make that thing go just as fast as it can go. I wanted to go fast as heck because we're going to pull that thing right out of her leg. So then I told her, I said, now, lady, this is going to hurt. And I, like the old days, there was a stick. I said, bite on it. Seen that in Western, you know. God. I says, bite on it. I says, and grab a hold of me or the steering wheel. And she says, okay. Boy, when I gave the signal, that popped right out. Ambulance drivers grabbed her right away, bandaged it up. They says, man, thank you. Away we went. Why I did that, I'd have no idea. It just came to me. Well, something's got to be done. She's sitting here bleeding, and the ambulance is there. We can't get her out of the car. Well, we'll saw that thing. She's not going to take the pain of you sawing that dog on because you haven't got enough room in there. So my idea was that record driver. And when he got done, he says, never did that before in my life. He says, I learned something. So, no, I think to answer your question, I hate beating around the bush, but every time you ask me something, it reminds me of something.
So you noted that you were a young sheriff. So I'm just wondering, it's 38, 39 years ago now that you stopped being sheriff. What would you – if you were sheriff now, if you were your age, the man you are now at that time, would you have done anything differently?
Yes, very definitely. I think I've been asked that question before. I think I did a lot of things impulsively. And now with a little more background, a little more stability, rationalizing some things and thinking some things out, yeah, I think there would have been. And not a lot, but I would think quite a bit of things there would be some different changes that probably I wouldn't have reacted the way I did being now. For example, the new sheriff got the guys in black uniforms. Oh, I'm so opposed to that. I was sitting in a restaurant 2 months ago eating, and I looked over there, and here's a guy, got a squad car out there, and I didn't see the squad car, and he's typing some notes on a computer. And I looked, and he's got black on. We wore black for the tactical mobile unit, okay, with the helmets and so on. And so I went over there, and I said, gee. And I looked at the patch and said, Washtenaw County Sheriff Department. I says, what are you on a field? Is this your field uniforms or what? He said, no, this is our new uniforms. Wearing jump boots, black uniforms, no hats. It's ridiculous. And I every time I see him, I get appalled. Because let me tell you, I always maintain one thing about my deputies. I said, you're going to be in full uniform. You're going to have the respect of that badge and that uniform, and I want people to respect you in that uniform. They aren't going to respect somebody with a hat off, okay, or a ball cap on. You will wear your hat at all times, stopping a vehicle or being out in public. In the car, I didn't care. But when you're out in public, you put that hat on. I said, you know, and I always admired the Michigan State Police. I wanted to be a trooper. I really wanted to be a trooper. And tell you the truth, Stan Burdine and I, when I was on Ipsy Pit Police, Stan Burdine was on the Ann Arbor Police, we failed the test. We come out of there, we thought we did. We come out of there, and we were told later on that we failed. Stan says, I didn't fail that test. I said, I didn't either. I know this. But in those days, the city police we don't want our men to go. We can't prove it. But anyway, so we didn't get to become state troopers. But you ever notice state trooper? Always neat, always got their hat on, very sharp looking, always, always. And I would say you maintain that kind of a uniform and you maintain the respect of it. And then this guy changes it into black and they don't wear a hat. Half of them don't wear a hat. And I sit out there and I wonder, I says, my gosh, what has happened to the sheriff department? And I've had a lot of people comment about it. They said, what are they doing? Are they trying to be ready for a riot? I said, I don't know what they're doing. I said, I have no idea. That is just, and our police never changed theirs. They're all black. Michigan State Police never changed theirs. They're all black. Other sheriff's departments throughout the county, when we first got in there, I changed the uniform. I changed the patch. I developed that patch, the Washtenaw County Sheriff's Department. We went to the brown uniform with the stripe. Pretty soon, other sheriff's departments. And pretty soon, we got Michigan Sheriff's Association. All were brown. Okay, that was kind of a significance. State police were all blue. We're all brown. Okay? You remember when the blue lights come on? Sheriff's Department come on with that first. State police says, no, we will stay red. That way you'll know it's a state trooper. If you see the blue, you're going to know it's a Washtenaw County, or you're going to know it's a sheriff department. So there's a difference there. Then all of a sudden, things changed. Now state police got blue and red. You know, see how things mold? And the sheriff's departments all went to black and white cars with the star. We became uniform. We became statewide. And then this guy changed it to black. And I've gone up through some of the other counties, and I get letters from some of the old sheriffs that I've talked to, and they're all still in the brown. And they asked me, so what's happened down in Washington? I said, don't talk to me about it, because I don't have no idea. I'm very, very upset with them, very.
Looking back now, do you feel the student protesters and the hippies were maybe right about anything that they were fighting for and believing in then?
I really don't know what they were fighting for. I honest to God, don't. I can't recall any particular thing that they were really significantly, you know, like we want better education or we want shorter hours or what. I don't know what they were fighting for. And the way that they did the things was, you know, by strength and by force. This was their thing. You know, never a group sitting down and saying, now look at, let's meet with the university and let's see if we can't dissolve this and find this out. No, we're going to lock ourselves in a public building. We're going to we'll form massive groups and we'll storm the city. And we will go down through South U, smashing business people's windows, smashing the Ann Arbor banks. This kind of destruction was, you know. And again, you got to understand, you get a couple of radicals, and now we get it. Those radicals get within a bunch of groups, and now they start hollering pretty soon. Oh, I'm with them. I'm going to holler too, you know. Hey, he's throwing a brick, so am I going to. Maybe you didn't intend to do it, but because you were in that group, and they were forming the group, and they got larger, and they got louder and louder. And the louder they got, the more violent they got. And that happens with any massive group. Only takes four or five ringleaders to get them riled up, you know. And all of a sudden, as a kid, boy, look at that crowd. Let's go, you know. Maybe we're in the back of it. And there's maybe 1,000 people, and you're back there with, you don't know what the heck you're doing there. You're marching with them and having fun. We've seen high school kids in there. Got no business in there. But because it was a crowd, it was a thing to do, and they were taking over the street. See how those things happen? And that's too bad. It's unfortunate that those type of things happen. But that is just, that's a massive crowd. It's still going on. Look at it in England, what has happened over there when they were protesting. Boy, bottles were Molotov cocktails, and the police, and I'm looking at them saying, my God, this is back in the 60s. Same thing happened. Massive crowds take over. You know, I got a army vehicle, and we had I had a water cannon put on top of it. I got that from Germany. Germany used a water cannon to prevent anybody getting hurt. So when we turned that water, and that was 100 pounds pressure, when we squirted them, take their feet right off from underneath them. It would end the crowd in a hurry. Eastern Michigan, we did that. That broke the crowd up. They didn't want to get wet. But nobody got hurt and nobody got arrested. Why didn't we have that in Ann Arbor? Didn't have it in Ann Arbor until they seen Germany using this water gun. They said, we're going to get one. So I got one.
I just wanted to ask, I had forgotten to ask this, about the recall campaign against you, and you were really singled out, particularly by the whole group, the White Panthers. They really singled you out as the law enforcement officer who was their enemy.
Yep.
And how did you feel about that? How did you regard the recall campaign?
I didn't feel anything about it, to tell you the truth, because, again, I had known this was a small group, and I knew it was a small group. And I knew that, you know, again, not being cocky or overconfident, I knew that I had the majority of the county. And, you know, I had the American Legions. I had the VFW. I had these strong groups that were saying, you know, you're our sheriff. Don't let these people, you know, fortifying me and so on. So I never had much respect for them as far as being anything if it was countywide. I might have been a little nervous, okay, but I wasn't because it was, again, a group. And, yeah, they wanted me out of there. They wanted me out of there. You know, At one particular time, I took my car, my Buick, I had a Buick, I took my car in to get serviced, okay? Now, I was always going on fatal accidents. I would, you know, I would travel at high speeds and so on my side of my red light whenever I had to do it. And I remember going to a fatal accident, and I picked up the coroner, and he was in the car with me, and I got the siren going and the red light, and he says, "Sheriff, slow down." He said, "They're dead. We can't help them. Just slow down." I'm taking them to, we already got reported that they're dead. I think in the corner. He said, "Just slow down." He said, "They're dead. We can't help them. We can't help them." But anyway, I was luckily not going fast. And I made the, coming down Liberty Street, and I turned onto Liberty off of Wagner Road, and my wheel fell off. Brand new Buick. So I got the wrecker driver there, and the wrecker picked it up, and he says, "Someone sabotaged your front end." They sawed it. You would see the saw marks in there, and it was just, he said, "Had you been on a high-speed chase, you'd have rolled this thing just as sure as life." So then, and for that day on, every time my car would go in for service, I had to have a detective or a deputy stand guard over the car to make sure that it would come back. You know, just, we had some tragic things too. You know, I had, in Washtenaw County's history, we had deputy, two deputies that were killed, three deputies actually were killed. And I'm going to tell you something really ironic, because the one deputy was killed coming to work, Jerry Russo, and he hit a tree and he was killed. And then I had Frank Campton and Harold Ewald. They were my transportation officers. And they were transporting this prisoner to Jackson Prison, and he had smuggled a handcuff key in his mouth and undid the handcuffs. And he grabbed Campton around the back of the neck and had his gun. And he shot Campton. And so then, well, Ewald, he turned his gun, and Ewald pulled the patrol car over, and he shot Ewald. And then he's running down the expressway with a gun in his hand, a black man with a handcuff hanging on. Running down the, and here's a young rookie policeman off duty in his car, and he sees this happening. And here Ewald is coming down in plain clothes, and he shoots at Ewald. Boy, I chewed that. You know, I said to him, I said, "What in God's creation were you thinking? Here's a black man running down the expressway with handcuffs hanging off of him and with a gun, and you shoot a man because he's coming at him with a gun, a white man." I mean, I don't, you know, you've got to understand, what would a policeman do with a handcuff? So anyway, Ewald died after that. When we come down, we took the funeral procession, we come down and we come by, and his wife requested that Harold Ewald come by the jail, okay? Now they come down Main Street. They got by the jail and had all my deputies who were not in the procession lined up on Main Street. As the funeral procession got to Main Street, the hearse stalled for two solid minutes. They timed it. Two solid minutes, and then it started back up. Talked to Mr. Mulek. He says, "Nothing has ever happened to my equipment in my life like that." And he took it to the garage, and they could not explain why that car stalled. Eerie. Huh? That was that was one of our sad times that we had with our two deputies. And I forgot to tell you about one. We had on Pontiac Trail, and I was always out of my car. I mean, after I got through at night, I would just go in my car. Real quickly, my captain and myself, Chester Wilson, I said, him and I used to ride patrol together when we were deputies. Now he's my captain, and I'm the sheriff. And I said, "Let's get into patrol car and go out patrolling." He said, "You really want to do that?" I says, "Yeah. I'll wear my uniform with the gold on it, you know, and the stars on there, and you wear yours." Captain Barr says, "Okay." We went out in a patrol car. Now, the desk is going crazy. I know they're all saying, "Hey, better shut up. The captain and the old man are out, you know, man. Just keep it down, you know." And so we are all over the county We can't find nothing. Nothing. We can't even find a red light. I mean, you know. And he says, Jesus, this isn't like the old days, is it? I says, no. He said, what? Did everybody know we're out and they're all gone home? So on our way back, we're coming down Carpenter Road. We get to Washington Avenue, and this car run a red light right dead in front of us. I says, there it is. Boy, we put the red light on, and we pulled him over. Two young hippies, okay? And right away, they says, well, looks like, he says, we got some pigs out here. Chester and I are going to handcuff this guy. And we're fighting with him. We're arguing with him and so on. Chester puts the handcuffs on me. I says, Chester, you darn, I mean, you could see us out there wrestling with this guy. We're trying to put the handcuffs on him, and he handcuffs me. We laughed about that. So we got him, finally got him to the jail, and the sergeant, and this guy says, he was still going on about it. He was drunk, going on about by the pigs and this, the pigs that, and my sergeant went up to him, and I was standing over there. He said, mister, you just got arrested by the head hog.
For more information on Doug Harvey, visit oldnews.aadl.org.
Music for this episode was Flux by Drop Trio, which you can find on the AADL catalog by going to aadl.org/magnitude.
AADL Talks to Doug Harvey is a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.